Vance Professionals, 1-800-922-3622. Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Privacy has become a potent political topic. All four legislative caucuses are planning privacy bills this year. DFL leaders have held hearings. Last week, House Republicans released their bill, which they call the Privacy Bill of Rights. Minnesota Attorney General Mike Hatch has criticized that proposal. He's keeping his own watch on privacy issues, including a pending lawsuit against Minnesota Public Radio over a disagreement on fundraising disclosure practices. There are other critics as well, press advocates who warn that the privacy measures can go too far and shut off information flow needed for a democratic society. We'll have a very public discussion today on these issues with Tim Pawlenty. He's the House Majority Leader and Republican State Representative from Eagan. He joins us in the studio. Thanks for doing so.
Good morning, Catherine. Pleasure to be here.
And we're also joined today by Jane Kirtley. She's Silha Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. She's a former executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She also joins us here in the studio. Thanks for doing so.
Thank you.
Tim Pawlenty, let's start with you. The House Republicans released their Privacy Bill of Rights last week. You say you want to safeguard against electronic window peeping. Can you
pull the shade on it?
Well, give me an example of what we're talking about.
Well, with the internet and the advance of electronics and telecommunications, there's the ability for people to access and potentially access sensitive information about us is concerning people, and it is a legitimate issue. We had just very recently in the news, for example, a lapse at Northwest Airlines security on their website where there was concern that people were booking airline reservations, sharing credit card information and other information about their itineraries and the like, and for a period of time that was non-secure and available over the internet. And so that's just one small example, but through the internet, through telecommunications, through government also, any time we have storage of data that's personal or sensitive, who keeps it, who they release it to, how it gets used is a significant public policy concern.
Now, my understanding is that one of the main tenets of your Privacy Bill of Rights is to stop the sale of government lists.
Yeah, we have first of all, the Bill of Rights, which is kind of a statement of principles, which we hope will guide the debate not only for this year, but for years to come as well. And that includes the basic things like making sure that you have notice over the fact that somebody's collecting data about you, that you have a chance to opt out or opt into the system, also have a chance to correct errors, also have a chance to hold people who have the data accountable if they misuse it, and a series of principles like that. But beyond the Bill of Rights, we also have a series of initiatives that we're proposing. The one that's probably got the most attention is the one that calls for the ban of the government selling data to resell to third parties that will use it for commercial solicitation.
And let's give folks an example, because we can palaver on for a long time, but let's give them something concrete.
A hard example would be you register with the state of Minnesota. The state requires you to provide certain information in connection with your driver's license, who you are, your address, your gender, your height, your weight, other information. That is a very valuable and potent information to people who are in commercial businesses who want to use it to target market you. And so we want to see that the state is not profiting from selling information that's personal while making sure that the balance is kept for access to the media, academics, recall notices, things that aren't commercial solicitation.
I mean, an example would be if you had bought a particular type of snowmobile. I remember reading this example. And then an insurance company might buy a list of everyone who's bought this model, and then they send out a letter saying, you need a special kind of insurance.
Yeah, or say, Catherine Lanfer, you go over to the Department of Transportation and find out that you are a reckless driver, you've had all kinds of violations, and that you are a high-risk person for insurance purposes. So there might be an insurance company.
This is purely hypothetical, I'd like to add.
There are rumors. But
thanks, I hate.
But anyway, you could be an insurance company that has as your market niche high-risk drivers, and you could send out solicitations saying, look, we notice that you have all these violations, you've been involved in accidents. We specialize in providing lower rates to high-risk drivers, and therefore we're marketing you on that message. And that to some people, that's invasive. It's more than government needs to know, or more than some of these insurance companies need to know.
All right. So are we going to see higher taxes? Because the sale of these lists brings in hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It does. It's a couple million dollars a year, actually. But in the overall scheme of things, it's not a lot of money, Catherine. And so we're hoping that, particularly in the era of surpluses, that money isn't going to be that sorely missed.
Jane Kirtley, I want to turn to you. I mean, obviously, privacy has become a very hot political topic. Now, the local society, the SPJ president, Gary Hill, the Society for
Professional
the,
Journalists.
I was going to say Preservation of Journalists, which shows you just where I think this privacy debate is going.
That's the organization I just left.
Yeah. but he has said that there's a presumption here that keeping stuff secret is benign. And I was wondering if you could extrapolate on that.
Well, I have a couple of comments. Mm-hmm. One of my concerns, and I've seen this kind of bill suggested in a variety of states and adopted in a variety of states, is that what it does is it gives the government not just the authority but the mandate to say to somebody, what are you going to do with this information you're asking for? And if we're talking about public information, which we are, it seems to me that it's a very chilling thing for the government to be able to say to somebody, now what do you intend to go and do with this? We have to decide whether we approve of that before we will let you have it. And there's been a case that's just been heard, or not heard rather, by the U.S. Supreme Court, which turns on this very specific issue. The court has vacated a California ruling dealing with this question, and it's still somewhat up in the air how that's going to play out. But I guess my point is this. I've had a lot of experience with journalists and members of the public requesting information, being, frankly, grilled by a records custodian about what they're going to do with the material. And it seems to me that that's inappropriate for government to do. Now, I, on the other hand, do have a problem with government profiting from public information. So insofar as we talk about the government making money off of it, I'm probably on the same side with the Republicans here in terms of trying to curtail profit-making, because profit-making often means that people don't anymore have an actual right to get access to information that's public because they can't afford to pay for it. But I don't think that's really the motivation here. I think the motivation here has to do with something that I think is very understandable and to a degree with which I sympathize, which is people don't like information to be used for quote-unquote bad purposes, or as the Bill of Rights, I think, here refers to it, misused. My problem is I don't know what that means. I don't know what misused means. Does it mean what Mr. Pawlenty doesn't like? Does it mean what I don't like? Does it mean conduct that's illegal? Well, conduct that's illegal, there ought to already be legal remedies to deal with that. And if there's a problem with some other conduct, then it seems to me the legislator ought to be considering that and prohibiting that conduct. Back when several years ago I was down in Chile, in Santiago, talking to representatives of the government there, they were grappling with the same problem. It's an international issue. They were concerned that health insurance companies would get health information about people, use it to discriminate against them, deny them policies and coverage. I said, isn't the way to deal with that not to close off access into the information, but to prohibit that kind of discrimination against these patients? Long pause, and they said, yes, you're right. That's the solution. We deal with the conduct, not with closing off the information. And that, I guess, would be my wish, that as the legislature looks at this question, they try to think of what it is they're really trying to accomplish.
Well, that is an interesting question. Tim Pawlenty, how do you define misuse?
Well, with most difficult issues, this is a question of balance. And again, here, we're saying, and by the way, there's numerous other components to our initiative as well, but on the government data piece, you know, we have a situation where we're not calling for the records to be closed or made not public. We want to make sure that everybody knows that this information would still remain public. It could still be accessed in bulk form, in computerized form, for purposes of academic research, for purposes of journalism, for purposes of law enforcement,
the courts. Well, then you have defined what use and misuse is.
Yeah, just zeroing in. Uh-huh. What we're after here is the transfer by government to third parties who will use data that government collects using its police powers to then turn around and use it for commercial solicitation. That's what we're after, and that's how we would define a misuse.
And is commercial solicitation illegal in the state of Minnesota?
No, but we do believe that when the government says, look, we have our police powers, our regulatory powers, we're going to force you to provide this information as a condition of driving, as a condition of duck hunting, as a condition of being a optometrist. You have to provide all this information to us. You have no choice. Otherwise, you have no vocation or hobby, the right to have a vocation or hobby in Minnesota. And by the way, once we force you to give you this information under duress, we're going to turn around and sell it to people so they can profit off it. And that's where I think we draw the line.
But what if you had the opt-in, opt-out? I mean, that's a phrase that you hear bandied about a lot. I mean, what if you provided people with an option of, yes, we need this information for this narrow channel, this narrow purpose, so that we know what kind of duck hunter you are, and we will take this information, but if you don't want us to sell it to anyone, then we won't.
That's an option. We didn't think it was as strong or as bold as the position that we have taken. But in the area of driver's license in Minnesota, we do allow an opt-out currently, Catherine. So if you don't want to provide the information on your driver's license, you can opt out, except for law enforcement or courts and a few other limited exceptions. We looked at that as an option for all of government data. In other words, it would continue. Somebody could purchase it and use it for commercial solicitation, but individuals would have the right to opt out. We didn't think that went far enough or was strong enough as in terms of where we wanted to head.
I guess I come back to the issue of, to me, and I believe Attorney General Hatch was quoted as saying this too, junk mail solicitation is something that I don't consider to be a major threat in my life. I can throw away junk mail. I can get on do not call lists. I have lots of self-help measures I can take to try to control unwanted solicitations. And to the extent that this initiative is going to help inform the public about that, I support it 100% because I'm a believer in the public, the individual taking control of his or her data to the extent that he or she feels is appropriate. And there are all kinds of things the individual can do, both in terms of governmental records and in other kinds of consumer interactions to do that. And a lot of people don't realize that. But again, to me, it is very troublesome that the government is designated certain activities that are purely legal as misuse and withholding access to information on that basis and that basis alone, when by everybody's agreement, this is public information.
But there is some hypocrisy here and a double standard, because Attorney General Hatch and others are pounding mercilessly on the private sector with respect to these issues, whether it be in healthcare, banking, you know, private sector data that people take for one purpose, that they collect for one purpose, and then sell or use to somebody else for another purpose. That's the entire theme of Attorney General Hatch's initiative.
Is that quite accurate? Because it seems to me that he also has directed his ire at the government as well. I mean, he shares your concerns about the selling of government lists.
He does support this. I mean, he said in the newspaper he supports our initiative in this regard.
In fact, he didn't think you had made it strong enough.
Well, in other areas,
it's
not
quote.
The government area, but I think he,
okay.
he in the government
mm-hmm.
area, he thinks. But the point is here, there's some double standard hypocrisy that says we're going to regulate the heck out of the private sector. They can't transfer data to third parties. They can't allow third parties to use it for other than its intended and approved purpose. But we in government are different. There's different rules for us. We can collect this data using our police powers, our regulatory powers, and force you to submit the data, and then we're going to turn around and sell it for profit. And
but he's against that. We just said that.
Attorney General Hatch is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say we're not going to have those rules for government, if the professor here would say, well, government's different, but we're going to apply it to the private sector, there's a bit of a double standard there.
Well, government is different because government, as you said, has tremendous authority to collect information. And if the debate was on whether government collects too much information, I would probably be on the side of saying absolutely it does. And ought that collection be regulated? Yes. But once it's in government hands, one of the few things that protects us as members of the public from government misuse is keeping that information available.
We agree.
So that members of the public can monitor what the government's got and what they're doing with it. So, I think government is different from the public private sector.
House Republicans have proposed a privacy bill of rights for Minnesotans that would prohibit some government agencies from selling mailing lists for commercial purposes. But critics say that if you look at the plan, perhaps it goes too far and that some of this discussion could lead us to an undemocratic society. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities and you'd like to join this conversation, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Now, just because there are so many proposals and ideas floating around out there, it's my understanding that your Privacy Bill of Rights proposal, which includes initiatives in it, would also require telemarketers to register with the state?
Yes, it has a number of other components to it. One is a cluster of initiatives under the heading of home privacy, and that would deal with some of the concerns over telemarketers. Particularly, there's concerns about telemarketers calling in someone anonymously, not being accountable for what's said or how the transaction's handled. So we'd like to establish a registration requirement for telemarketers doing business in Minnesota and then use the proceeds from that registration requirement for a public relations effort to also inform people about the do not call system, which is currently in place. We also would prohibit telemarketers from blocking their identity when they call in. Currently, a lot of people have a caller ID, and telemarketers use kind of an anonymous or out-of-area identification symbol. We would prohibit that so you could see who's calling in. And then we would also increase current penalties for violations of the do not call system. When somebody requests that they be taken off the list, if they're not, we would increase the penalties for the failure of the telemarketers to do that.
We're going to go to Joey in Cambridge. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
My concern, everybody's talking about the rights of the government and what it's going to interfere with information and things like that, and I think that's fine and dandy, but the information is about me, and it's mine, and nobody's really talking about that. It should be my choice what information is available and to whom. And oftentimes, you don't get that information. When I, and the other thing, concern I have is, why is it so much worried about the government? I think it should be the whole private sector. I'm really surprised. I'm not from Minnesota, and when I came here, I found out that there are no rights to privacy. There's no laws in this state about your right to privacy, like when you go to get employment or whatever. They have the right to ask you anything, and you have to answer them.
Joy, actually, we have a Data Privacy Act that was passed. I'll go to Professor
Yeah,
Kirtland.
I can't tell you the exact date that it was passed, but, I mean, your state Supreme Court just earlier, well, I guess it was last year now that we're in 2000, has recognized the right to privacy in this state. And in terms of the legislation catching up with it, it may take a little while, but the right to privacy has been recognized in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure that part of the initiatives that are being considered in the legislature now are going to expand that, codify it. But I think that, you know, it could well be that you may have run up against someone who's not fully familiar with what the restrictions are on
Well, and it's also interesting, I think, that we have a lot of different definitions of privacy floating
around.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you know, the way Justice Brandeis defined it back 110 years ago was the right to be left alone. The point of the my concern here is that the government really doesn't leave us alone at all. And to the extent that the government is gathering information of us and we are passively allowing that to happen, I think that it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we have the ability to oversee what they do with that. Now, as I said earlier, as far as the private sector is concerned, I'm a supporter of the notion of private enterprise, whatever it may be, fully informing people of what kind of information they're collecting on them. And I think the kinds of things that are proposed in this Bill of Rights in terms of things like access, right to correct, and so forth, are things that we've already seen in certain aspects of the industry, some voluntarily, some by federal government fiat, like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which essentially gives you the same rights that are being articulated in this Privacy Bill of Rights. So this is not a new concept. It's just being expanded to cover other sectors of society. And again, to a great extent, at least in theory, I would support most of that. My major concern really does rest with government information because to the extent that government can collects information over us, that gives us a lot of power in terms of what our lives are about. Selective release of information, which is what we're talking about here, where certain categories of requesters get access and others don't, is, in my experience, very dangerous, because what it means is that it often suggests that there's some stigma attached with the release of information, even benign information like name, address, phone number, that kind of thing, or even things like medical information that theoretically oughtn't to have a stigma at all, although clearly its release to the wrong person could have some serious consequences. So I do focus on the government regulation aspect of this. As far as the private sector is concerned, I'm not here as a spokesperson for telemarketers. My only caveat about the registration requirements and so forth are that there is federal constitutional law that protects commercial speech, and there are some restrictions on what government can do about controlling commercial speech. It can be controlled more than other kinds of speech, but it's not open season on it either.
We're going to go to Alan in Minnetonka. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Alan.
Good morning.
Hi.
I guess my biggest comment on this would be the ability for people to opt in. Opting out's been around for quite a while. It's a lot less restrictive than opting in, where you have to do an affirmative to say, yes, I'm wide open for anything that anyone wants to telemarket or anything else. That was discussed in an article by Mr. Hatch a little bit, but he's kind of wishy-washy on the issue, I guess. What is everyone's opinion on that, I guess?
Well, you've had opt-out in Minnesota for quite a number of years as far as the driver's license records are concerned, is my understanding. And one of the statistics I read, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Mahlante, is that about 20% of Minnesota drivers have chosen to opt out. So that's been available, but people have chosen not to do it. Now, you know, I've heard a lot of discussion all around the country that opt-in is better because it means you have to affirmatively sign up, basically, to have your information made available. But again, I question about how concerned about this people really are if they've had the option to opt out just by checking a box. I mean, I just got a Minnesota driver's license a few months ago. I can check that box. It was not hard to do. It took me less than 2 seconds. if only 20% of the drivers in Minnesota have bothered to do it, then are we getting very excited about something that really doesn't excite a lot of people?
Well, actually, in fact, that recent article that was in the Star Tribune Sunday said that politicians seem to be doing very well with this as a topic, and yet you don't really see that much hue and cry from the general public about it. So sort of hard to figure that one out.
You know, Minnesota has been, just really back to an earlier question, very slow to respond in this area. It's true that the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized for the first time the right of or tort of invasion of privacy in Minnesota, but we were the last state in the nation to do it. We were the absolute last state in the nation to do it. We do have a data practices statute, as you mentioned, Catherine, as well, that relates to government data. But as to the caller's question, you know, opt-in versus opt-out, I think those are subtle differences. It's kind of inside baseball. But the key thing is we got to make sure people have notice and awareness that the data is being collected and a right to get out of the system if they can. And as to the last point, you know, privacy is kind of like airplane noise. I live out in Eagan, and you can have people living in the same neighborhood with the same flights going over their neighborhood. And for one person, it's intolerable. I mean, it just drives them crazy. And for another person, it hardly bothers them at all. And so it's quite subjective. And for one person, the fact that the government has and sells your address, your weight, your height, other information about you, you know, it's no big deal. They don't care. For some subset of the population, it's a huge deal, and it's very intrusive.
We're going to go to Sam in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. Firstly, I'm an attorney, and I have dealt regularly with the issue of government data practice act, including requesting opinions of the commissioner, and et cetera, and making requests. My experience and experience many people have had who've dealt with government over these issues is that they really don't want to observe the law. They flagrantly release stuff that they shouldn't be doing, and at other times refuse to release what they should. There is basically little easy means of enforcing even current laws, yet alone any additional laws. Initially, a number of years ago, the legislation allowed the Commissioner of Administration to issue what was called advisory opinions concerning what the law should be, yet we find regularly the courts disregarding them, and even government agencies refusing to respond with details to requests from the commissioner for information, with something that a private citizen couldn't do, but government officials tried to do. In order for someone who was denied information from the government or has their information released, the only enforcement vehicle is to file an expensive lawsuit. And, of course, that lawsuit will be appealed. I can guarantee it, no matter who wins or loses. That is not a means of helping the citizen protect his privacy or gain access to public information. Also, there is a provision, two provisions in the current law, one which says that a person who's flagrantly violates...
Sam, I need you to round up to your point here.
Okay.
Just round up to it.
Well, all I'm saying is there is two issues in the law which allow for criminal prosecution of government agents that violate the law or for attorney fees, but neither one has ever been executed or seldom executed. You can't find that any government official has ever been criminally convicted, at least I don't know of any, for violation of the law.
So you say there's a question of enforcement here that you need to look at.
There's a serious issue of enforcement.
Okay, thank you, Sam. And how do we look at that?
Well, Catherine, first of all, anybody, if you want a mind-numbing experience, try to read the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. It's Chapter 13 of Minnesota statutes. It is a demonstration of government regulation gone wild. I mean, even for lawyers, it's hard to understand. It's borderline incomprehensible. It's internally contradictory. It is well-intentioned, for sure, but it is an example of government trying to micromanage and split hairs in ways that have caused all kinds of enforcement problems because the statute itself is so complex. Even lawyers can't understand,
so
much less.
So getting to Sam's point, isn't that a worry here?
Well, which is the part of the solution here is a simple solution, which is stop the practice, the one that we're trying to regulate. You know, there's other balances to be brought into the mix. But Sam's point in part in terms of current enforcement doesn't help the problem because the Data Practices Act itself hides all kinds of data. It has all sorts of categories of confidential and private data under certain circumstances, and it's a nightmare.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that the Minnesota Data Practices Act needs overhaul, and it is a mess, and it's impossible to understand, and with that I concur. But this kind of, you know, across-the-board, let's just close it off solution is not the answer to the problem.
We are talking to Tim Pawlenty. He's House Majority Leader, Republican State Representative from Eagan. And we're talking to Jane Kirtley, Silhaw Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. We are talking about the House Republican Privacy Bill of Rights. Privacy is a very potent political topic. Do you support the proposals to prohibit government agencies from selling information lists for commercial purposes? Tell us why or why not. It's 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Patty Marsicano. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thanks, Catherine. A federal judge has upheld the decision of the Decatur, Illinois School Board to expel six high school students involved in a football game brawl last year and whose dispute with the school district prompted Jesse Jackson to get involved. The judge ruled the students failed to prove the school board violated their rights by following a zero-tolerance anti-violence policy. Maryland officials have fired seven guards at a juvenile boot camp where teenagers say guards physically abused them. Last month, Maryland's governor fired the state's juvenile justice secretary and three other department employees amid the allegations, which were uncovered by a Baltimore Sun investigation. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that employees cannot sue states in federal court over allegations of age bias. The court ruled 5-4 in cases that came from Florida and Alabama. The Minnesota Conference of Chief Judges proposes to make it harder for attorneys to remove judges from cases. Right now, attorneys can remove the first judge assigned to their case without giving a reason. The conference wants to abolish that rule. Conference Chair Judge Leslie Metzen says the removal without cause rule allows attorneys to do what she calls judge shopping, which she says is improper. Attorney groups oppose abolishing the removal rule, saying it enhances confidence in the legal system. The Guthrie Theater Board has unanimously approved a riverfront site for a new theater complex. The new structure would cost an estimated $70 million. The Minnesota State forecast for today, partly to mostly sunny skies. There is a chance of afternoon snow in the southwest, the highs in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow, partly to mostly cloudy skies, a chance of light snow in the central and southern parts of the state, the highs tomorrow in the 20s. On Thursday, a chance of snow in the southeast, otherwise dry, the highs from the teens in the north to the 20s in the south. Right now in Mankato, it's 10 above. In the Twin Cities, it's 12 above. And Catherine, that's the news.
Thanks, Patty. Today's programming is sponsored in part to wish Happy Birthday Alice from Phoebe and Jerry.
Rural drug users are cooking up methamphetamine in hunting shacks, cabins, and even fish houses. I'm Rachel Reeby. Join us for a special Main Street broadcast on the alarming increase of rural meth labs. The second hour of our show will look at spiritual retreats, the latest fix for frazzled souls. Main Street, live from Collegeville, tomorrow at 11 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're continuing our conversation about privacy with Tim Pawlenty, House Majority Leader and Republican State Representative from Eagan, and with Jane Kirtley. She's Silhaw Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. She's a former Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Now, a reminder that if you are interested in privacy, you can go to npr.org. We have the archives of our privacy project there called the Surveillance Society. We're going to go to Eric in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you.
Hi.
I was just wondering if the people on your show could discuss the disadvantages that could occur to the public if this law is passed. I'm thinking of mostly merchants who purchase these lists to get information to customers that they want to serve, that the cost would increase to get the information to these certain sectors of the market if this law were passed.
Well, I think, again, I'm not here as a speaker for merchants or telemarketers, but certainly I know that people in the Direct Marketing Association will tell you that costs will go up if they're not able to do what they consider to be targeted advertising, which is much more cost effective. To me, that is an interesting argument. It's an interesting one in a capitalist society, and one that I think should be given appropriate weight. But again, I go back to my fundamental point, which is simply that if government information is supposed to be public information, then it ought to be available to all comers. And it frankly is not incumbent upon the government, in my view, to say, and what are you going to do with it, sir? What are you going to do with it, madam? If the subsequent conduct is illegal, there should be remedies in place to deal with that. But to start from the presumption that we're going to let the government decide what's an appropriate use or non-use, short of legislating to prohibit it, is to me a very slippery slope that is invading the public's right to know as a general matter. Now, I recognize that there's strong support, at least in some segments of the state government, to say, well, we'll have carve-outs for academics like me. We'll have carve-outs for academics like journalists or journalists like Catherine. I don't really like carve-outs because that also means that then the government is put in a position of defining who's a journalist. And I'm not sure I know who a journalist is these days. I didn't know 10 years ago. Today, I certainly don't know who that is. And so while I appreciate the balance that's trying to be struck here, it seems to me that, again, we're sort of losing sight of what our ultimate problem is, or at least what I think the problem is, which is what we would characterize as misuse of information. Well, a lot of people think that having the fact that they were arrested on the front page of the St. Paul or the Minneapolis paper would be misuse of their information. So, yes, I mean, we can say, oh, well, that's protected by the First Amendment, but I can assure you that there are forces around the country that are trying very hard to make it illegal to use it for that purpose. So I see this as a slippery slope that can easily snowball into a major crisis in terms of government accountability.
And there we go. That is one of those core questions. What is misuse of information? It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000.
But just briefly, Catherine, you know, everybody's a carve-out under our bill unless you are going to use the data for commercial solicitation. In simple terms, we don't believe it's an appropriate function of government to act as the marketing database development arm of private entities. And if they want to go out and do target marketing and niche marketing, then go develop their own marketing database. Government shouldn't use its regulatory and police powers to extract data from its citizens and then turn around and act as the marketing database manager for some telemarketing firm.
Is political use of this information considered commercial?
No, although we'd be willing to go that far if it was constitutional.
We'll Happily, it's not for your sake, right?
We'll go to Lynn in Lakeville. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. I have a question for Mrs. Lundy. I'm very much concerned about the release of data on myself by government, and I'm amazed to hear this reporter taking the side that she does. But Mrs. Lamper, you can tell me whether this relates to this topic. A big privacy concern I have, and I wish somebody would address it, is that when I call a firm, say, to get some product information on a defective dishwasher or something, or if I call any firm now, I get a recorded announcement saying that this call is going to be monitored, and they all say for quality purposes, and sometimes recorded. And I think that should be made illegal. I sometimes try to opt out, and most often you can't. I've been told, well, if you don't like this, hang up. The only state that you can opt out of this sort of thing in is Maryland. They have a law saying that you cannot have third-party monitoring of phone calls without permission. Linda Tripp is in trouble on that right now. And if you say to a person in Maryland on the phone, look, I don't want my call monitored. I'm not an employee of your company. I just bought your dishwasher or refrigerator or whatever, I'm not an employee of your company. I don't want this monitor recorded. They back off right away, but not firms in Minnesota or other states. That's my first point. The other point is I'm amazed to hear a reporter not standing up for individual rights in this respect. I think I've got her name, this reporter forgets that
she's a professor. She's a professor of media and law.
Okay, well, all right, then
just
perhaps
so you
she
know.
Was a reporter. But anyway, I think she's forgetting that newspapers, radio, and television are private business enterprises, and the bottom line is that they're in business to support their stockholders' investment. They have the right not to be regulated by government, and that's all. They don't have any special rights that, for example, I don't have if I'm inquiring into something. I I'm just amazed that this person is standing up for my individual civil liberty not to have information that...
Len, I'm going to stop you here because it sounds to me like you're contradicting yourself. You've just said that newspapers exist to line the pockets of their shareholders, so why should it surprise you? Then at the same breath, you turn around and say that reporters supposed to stick up for individual
rights. Because I have the feeling that I always have felt, and I did this sort of thing myself for many years, ma'am, I always had the feeling that that reporters have kind of a tendency to do that. I'm amazed to hear this person, this professor of media, saying things that she does.
Well, then let's give her a chance to clarify.
Thank you. Well, I think that perhaps the caller, I'm not expressing myself very clearly for the caller. I believe in individual rights. I believe in self-help. I believe in individuals questioning their government about why they collect information about them in the first place. I also have to correct your point that only Maryland prohibits this non-consensual recording. That's not true. About a dozen states prohibit it. But be that as it may, the point is that there are all kinds of steps that the individual can take to control dissemination of their data. They can make choices. They aren't as informed about that as many of them ought to be, and to the extent that the government will help to educate them about that, I applaud that, and I think it's a good thing to do. Also, I think that part of the problem in this discussion, at least for me, is that we seem to be putting all personal data or personally identifiable data into the same hopper. It's all being treated as if it's equally offensive for that information to become public or more widely public than it might otherwise have been. There was a decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit a couple of years ago in which a judge basically said that he thought, in his view, that anything you could observe about somebody just standing and looking at them, hair color, eye color, height, weight, and so forth, he did not see that as a major intrusion into somebody's private life, or information you could get in out of the phone book, a phone, an address, or a telephone number. Now, you might disagree with that, and I might disagree with that. I guess the point of this, though, is to say that all information is not created equal, and to suggest that simply because it's got your name on it, that means that its release is highly offensive, especially its release for commercial purposes that are not otherwise illegal, is the problem that I have. I think that citizens ought to be informing themselves about things like their credit card company's policies, their bank's policies, and making their choices appropriately, choosing to use those vendors and those merchants who have privacy policies with which they agree. And a lot of companies are under a lot of pressure these days as a competitive matter to reassure their customers that they're not misusing their data. I won't use a credit card if I know that that particular credit card company is going to share my data. That's a consumer choice that I make, and I didn't need the government stepping in to do that for me.
We're going to go to Jim in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess I would just like to, I work in the database marketing industry, and I would like to point out, I realize the professor is supportive of, kind of from a general democratic point of view, of you know, the government being able to provide information without judging who is a good user of the information and who is not. And I guess I would like to, you know, kind of explain what exactly are the main interests from a commercial point of view in being able to use this information. And basically what it is that when you have information that allows you to specifically target individual people, there is enormous savings in distribution costs for goods and services, without which you will have, you will experience higher unemployment, higher problems, higher inability of small businesses, for example, daycare centers, to be able to start up. You'll have higher costs in a lot of different areas. And so the idea that we're going to start regulating the amount of information available to those without taking into account the actual cost to society, I think is pretty worrisome, especially coming from kind of the Republican position. Supposedly they're regulating government now, but it seems to me it's just another regulation on private industry, and it's I guess I'm very worried about that.
Jim Pawlenty.
Well, again, I don't think it's a high or appropriate function of government to be collecting data to build a marketing database for businesses. That's not a function that's articulated in the Constitution. I think it's hard to defend from a policy standpoint. Of course it benefits business. I don't dispute that. But that is not a high or appropriate function of government. I just disagree with the caller, respectfully.
We're going to go to Peter in Golden Valley. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I think we should look at the basics. I think people have a right to be private, safe, and secure in their own home. And for some people, that means not having their address known to people that may try to harm them. If you're in a situation where there's a criminal that wants to try to find out where you live in order to do harm to you, they can pay $25 to $30 to a name search firm. And if you've ever received any mail at your home, you've ever put your name on your property title, you've ever voted, numerous other things, they can get that information very easily. Now, it used to be that to get a lot of this information, it was in a dusty book in the back of some county records office or somewhere. It was very difficult for somebody to go and gather it. Nowadays, it's published on CD-ROMs. For $20, you can get a list of everybody's phone number and address that's in the phone book. You know, that was they apparently allowed that. And the rise of the computer and the ease of transmitting and collating information is where this problem has now arisen, where it wasn't so much of a problem in the past. I think we need some changes in the areas of in allowing privacy on title, so that when you buy a piece of property, your name and address is not released because of that.
Well, Peter, I'm going to interject here, because in the same way that you can come up with an anecdote or a situation where it'd be hurtful for this stuff to be public, can't you see where people could also just as easily come up with a situation where it'd be hurtful not to know?
I can't think of a situation. I believe the police have a right to know where you live, but other than that, I don't think the information should be released.
Well, then let's go to Professor Kirtley.
I mean, I hope you're not suggesting, because, I mean, the Anglo-American tradition going back God knows how many centuries of having property title, public information, this is not a new phenomenon.
There are states that allow, for instance, a woman who is being stalked by a former spouse who wants to move and legitimately not have that spouse be able to find out where she is. There are states that have provisions that allow her to purchase a property and have her address protected.
Well, you're talking about a case-by-case analysis, which is similar to the same analysis you would have if you, say, had a restraining order.
Well, yeah, individuals have case-by-case situations,
right.
And I believe individuals should have rights to protect their privacy.
Well, but, Peter, doesn't this go back to what Professor Kirtley was saying earlier, that rather than shutting down the flow of information, which, you know, some people see as something that you need to have a democratic society, that rather than shutting down the information, you instead make provisions on the conduct? So, in other words, you go after the stalker, you don't go after the rest of society by making sure that all these different things are secret.
You're assuming that laws stop people from doing things, and they oftentimes don't.
Well, I would also add that laws that are supposed to promote privacy can also have unintended consequences. For example, the kind of title secrecy that you're talking about could lead to massive frauds. I mean, I've just been reading in the paper here about some accusations anyway about some real estate improprieties in the Twin Cities with people churning property over and so forth. I mean, my point is not to criticize any particular person, but simply to say that you're kind of assuming that only good people would choose to keep, for example, the title to their property secret. That becomes a way for people that have nefarious purposes for trading in property to keep that information secret as well. It can lead to fraud. It can lead to all kinds of criminal consequences. I think, on the whole, our society has profited by keeping this kind of information public, because these are matters in which the public as a whole has an overriding interest. Knowing who's on voter registration lists prevents vote fraud, for example, or at least can help do that. Knowing who owns property can prevent land fraud. The concerns about privacy, which tend to be somewhat amorphous and, as you suggested, oftentimes are limited to a very particular person, to make it one size fits all, I think, means we undercut a lot of principles that we've had for a long time.
But it is interesting to note, for instance, you were saying earlier, Professor Kirtley, that something like height, weight, your address, that is public, that isn't considered private. But what he's suggesting is that as we go on and perhaps feel more attacked by the different engines of communication around us, you do start to think of your phone number or your address as private.
Well, I think, Catherine, that's a good point, and maybe this is more of a down-the-road debate, but you have a situation where we want to balance competing interests. We want to balance the obvious value in having data public and the public's right to know and public information and all the benefits that flows from that, including the ones that have been described by the professor, versus an increasing expectation that has been recognized in our U.S. Constitution, which has now been recognized in our Minnesota common law, of a person's right to privacy. And, you know, the boundaries of where that right to privacy extends need to be debated. I mean, do you really need to know as a matter of government interest where I live? You know, what color my hair is, how tall I am,
Does who need to know? I mean, I think that's a fair question.
Who owns the data? My data, or is that the government's data?
Well, the courts have not really made clear who owns that property or that information, although there have been attempts to argue that it belongs to the individual, not successful to date. But having said that, I think that your point is well taken, which is, is it not fair to say that a government, any given government, probably collects a lot of information about us that's personally identifiable, for which it really doesn't have a clear purpose, and which can be misused in a whole variety of ways, both internally and externally? And ought we not be looking at that question about whether the government is collecting more information about us than it really needs to have?
On that point, though, Professor, let's assume that's true, that government, there's some regulatory or police reason why government needs to collect this data for enforcement. Let's say you're regulating optometrists or something. So you need to know who's a licensed optometrist, who's passed the exam, where they live, how to get a hold of them, whether they got malpractice insurance. That's a legitimate police, regulatory function of government. So in the process, then, if I'm an optometrist, I'm providing that plus personal identifying information to the government for that purpose. Then is it an appropriate function of government to turn around and sell that in an open market to a telemarketer?
I am amazed that Republicans are saying that selling information for the purposes of people using it for legitimate capitalistic purposes is somehow is a horrible thing to happen. But be that as it may, again,
well, we don't sell. I don't want to be in favor of selling people's constitutional rights.
Well, I don't.
Maybe you do.
Well, I don't think that's exactly what's going on here. I think we're selling government collected information, which is public information and which is available to any other requester for whatever charge is being made, whether it's a cost recovery or profit making. And what you're doing is discriminating against one class of requesters because you don't happen to like what they're doing with it, even though it's perfectly legal. And my point is, if you can do it to the commercial requester, then I think you're going to be able to do it to the people I represent, which are journalists, because you'll say, well, I don't like the way the St. Paul Pioneer Press uses this information. I don't like the fact that they're running a whole list of who's brought property in the Twin Cities in the last 6 months, and so I'm going to declare that a misuse, and they can't have it either. And as one of the callers said, isn't the St. Paul Pioneer Press a commercial enterprise? It certainly makes money, so how are you going to draw a rational decision?
Well, that's the press's argument, which is you can't draw any distinctions because the press will be next. And where does this parade of horribles end? And I think there's a little bit of an alarmist perspective there that I don't think we necessarily need to jump to.
And, of course, there's no alarmist perspective at all to the privacy argument, is there?
We're going to go to Larry in Manhattan Beach. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, and thank you. I think this discussion is...
Larry, you need to move your mouth closer to the phone.
Okay. I believe this discussion is a bit like putting your finger in the dike at this point. Given the age of technology and the development of computers and the databases that are out there now, I think it's kind of the price of the technology that we're living with. We've got some wonderful life values that are brought to us by this technology. Case in point here, with this legislation, it would prohibit the discussion of public policy in many cases, because sometimes this database is used to acquire a list of a special interest group or users or registries of a particular item.
Like, for instance, when we had the discussion on the hunting and fishing
amendment? Hunting, fishing, cross-country skiing, and, for example, property owners associations. I can go to my local county here, purchase a database, a disk of people who own property around lakes who have dwellings on them in excess of $200,000 in value. I know then that's a good group to contact for maybe environmental issues. I know they live in the metro area. I can learn a lot of things about them, and so I think there'd be a great impact on public policy process if the lists were not available to nonprofit organizations for those purposes. So,
but that's the confusion. You're not doing commercial solicitation, and we're not calling for prohibiting access to the list for any other purpose.
Yeah, but it's back to that slippery slope thing, and I really think, given the information that's out there on people now when they use their credit card, when they register for anything, I think for the government to do this now is a bit short-sighted. I think the policing, I don't think the cost-benefit analysis would prove out here that this is a good thing for the government to do.
All right. Thanks, Larry. We're going to go to Francisco in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning. Listen, I really don't want the government selling anything I have to give to them. Me being a European, I'm totally amazed what the arguments here. In Europe, any information I would give to the government because I had to is totally protected, and I cannot see that the government has any business selling any of my information I have to give to them to be legal, to be on the up and upper. I don't want them to give anything away from what I have to give to them. There got to be total protection for me. Commercial value or not, I don't want to have anybody have any information about me other than the government, because I have to be on the upper ground. Otherwise, I had to go underground.
Well, you know, the European view on this privacy issue is very different from that of the United States, and it has a lot to do with our cultural and governmental traditions. There's a strong belief in Europe at the moment that the government is the best entity to protect people's privacy, and they cite back to the history of Europe in the 1940s during the totalitarian regimes. And the logic is that if the government knows who maintains databases, it'll be able to control them and make sure that it's not misused. Of course, another way to interpret that would be to say that if the government knows who has databases and can control them, then it can grab hold of them and someday use them against people in ways very similar to what happened 60 or 70 years ago. I'm not trying to draw a criticism necessarily of the European approach. I'm just saying that it's quite different from the U.S. approach. And right now there's a major struggle going on in Washington, D.C., where we're struggling to try to balance what the European Union is demanding in terms of what they define as personal privacy and what has been the tradition in this country. But I have to tell you that it raises serious constitutional questions of free speech if we try to engraft the European standard onto the American standard. I appreciate what you're saying. I've heard very eloquent people from Europe argue your point of view, but I have to tell you that it is in conflict with some fundamental American principles, and I'm not quite sure how it's going to be resolved.
We're going to go to Mark in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Oh, good morning. I think all of the legislators who are working on this deserve to be congratulated. We already have one, I think, fairly clear example of how data can be handled with balancing, which is voter records, where the information can be provided to people with a legitimate need, those who want to contact voters, but only for non-commercial purposes. And personally, my biggest objection is when mortgage companies buy property tax records and you get 10 or 15 calls a week from people trying to get you to refinance. And I think that standard seems to me to be a good one, which is if you're going to, the government's going to sell it, they shouldn't be selling it for a commercial purpose.
Can I give you a quick example of what happened in the state of Florida when this issue was being debated in a very specific area? The veterinarians got together and went to the state legislator and said, we want you to close off access to rabies vaccination records for pets because we think that pets and their vets have a privacy interest, pet vet privacy, sort of like doctor-patient privacy. And everybody said, oh, yeah, that's a really good idea. We should close off that record so you won't know whether your neighbor's dog has been vaccinated against rabies. That's good. Well, it turns out that the motivation for this was that the rabies vaccination list had been bought by commercial pet food providers who were using it to solicit the owners of pets. And the veterinarians didn't like that because they had been doing a very lucrative business in selling pet food themselves. They were citing this vet-pet privilege, but it really was all about commercial interests. I raise this only to say that there are always competing interests here, and the need to strike a balance and to not criminalize conduct that we haven't statutorily criminalized is my biggest concern about this proposal.
Tim Pawlenty.
Well, again, we're not proposing to close these records. In the case that you just cited, you'd still be able to go to the records and access an individual file for a non-commercial purpose and inquire whether the dog has been vaccinated. So there's a lot of red herrings in this argument. That's not the direction that we're headed. I understand the slippery slope argument, but you know, then you might as well just throw your hands up and say we can do nothing, because once you draw any distinctions in this area, you know, it somehow might lead to restrictions on the press, and I think it can be managed more astutely than that.
Do you think that there is a public outcry for this legislation? I know the four caucuses are looking at it, but I also have noted both on this particular show today and just in some of the press coverage that it seems like there's a great debate going on and many people in the public aren't necessarily engaged.
It's not the kind of thing that you